Welcome to the Cycle Systems Academy podcast. This week, we're really going to get into cycle touring again, and we're speaking to long-term podcast listener Andy Petit in New Zealand. How are you doing, Andy?
I'm good. Yeah, great. Summer's just arrived over here, so it's shorts from dawn till dusk. But yeah, it's good. It's nice cycling weather, nice touring weather.
Awesome. Good to hear it. Well, we're going to talk about cycle touring and such and your life with bikes. But before we do that, we actually met you in New Zealand and we stayed with you through the whole warm showers app thing. But you said you'd been a long-term podcast listener. So I was just interested, where did you discover our podcast? Was it through the Bellowcast or just Googling about?
Good question. Oh, crikey. Possibly the Bellowcast. I mean, I, in the early days of podcasting, I would sort of roam through the podcast app, YouTube, iTunes podcast, and I'd type in like cycling or touring or, you know, whatever. And I think yours came up that way, and I clicked on it, and I've stuck with it ever since. Yeah, it's one of the ones I look forward to every week. But that way.
Oh, that's nice. And have you had any particular favourite shows?
I've got to confess, the Campag Kid. Kindred spirits. We're about the same age, same passion for classic bikes, classic Italian bikes, and old Campag. So yeah, he's really good. I binge listened to all of those one after the other, which was good.
I really enjoyed those, and I don't know if you follow him on Instagram, but the Campag Kid is just as good with Shimano as well. There's photos on his Instagram of disassembled, cleaned up and rebuilt Dura-Race levers, which any bike mechanic out there knows that is not straightforward at all. There are not exploded diagrams on Shimano's website on how to do that. You'll be really glad to know we've got the Campag Kid coming back soon. Wonderful. But he's so fastidious that the subject we're going to cover, he said, look, there's some gaps in my knowledge, so I'm going to speak to an expert and then come back to you. So we're going to have a really, really great show about a classic bike brand rather than Campagnolo soon. So what I wanted to look at was the whole world of cycle touring, because, of course, when I was growing up, you race bikes or you toured bikes, and of course you just rode bikes. But cycle touring was quite a big thing. You know, the Cyclist Touring Club in England was quite a big thing, and I know you've got some English roots as well. And it kind of fell out of fashion, you know, and it became something that was regarded with disdain. And, you know, the CCC guy with a carrier bag full of oily bike parts coming into the bike shop has been a standing joke of this podcast, as you all know. Oh, hello. But funnily enough,
sandals.
Yeah, exactly. But funnily enough, cycle touring's now like the coolest thing, isn't it? And it's quite curious. So essentially, how did you get into cycle touring, and what was your first tour?
That would have been on an old road racing bike from out there in the early 90s. I was working at Gatwick Airport. Excuse me. And there was a fellow cyclist I was working with, and we just discussed it. And we actually had enough relatives living in the south of England that we could stay with a different relative all the way to Bristol and then back to Horsham. Yeah, so it was good. So easy touring. So it was a warm bed, it was warm shower. It was a warm bed, a warm hot shower and a hot dinner every night. But the first proper one where I actually carried a tent would have been probably a couple of years later. Again, slightly better prepared, and then down around the Isle of Wight and back up, I've done it a few times. It's a wonderful tour. It's the Isle of Wight. It's its own little self-contained community. Where it's an island, but it's good. It's one of those places that feels slightly different when you're in your own country. It just feels like you're slightly outside of that country, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So you lived in England a long time, so because obviously you're a Kiwi, so how long were you in England for?
I'm a POM, believe it or not. I was born in England, and then we emigrated in 71, first to Australia and then to New Zealand. So I did, I was nine. So I was here from 73 to 84. Then in 84, I went back to the UK and I was back over there for 24 years. So then that's kind of when I got into more into bicycles and quality bicycles, and I started to know the different brands and the componentry, and I got the early-ish mountain bike scene, like late 80s, early 90s, like the Melbourne Classic and things like that. So yeah, it was, and I had a bit of money to spend on better equipment as well. So yeah,
awesome.
So let's get into the UK in 2008. Sorry, yeah.
Well, let's get into the equipment then. So if we look at that first tour down to the Isle of Wight, what were you riding and what sort of kit did you have? Because it obviously wasn't 200 gram sleeping bags and bikepacking bags, was it?
Or roll off and yeah, no, none of that. it would have been, that would have been my Roberts. That was either, I treated myself to a Roberts. This is when I was starting to know about bikes and tubing and componentry and builders. And I'd heard of Colnago, and I was reading up, and it was like, oh, Chaz Roberts. And it was like, you know, who, at that time, who's the best frame? It was in a magazine. Who's the best frame builder in the world? And it was between Ernesto or Ernesto's company and Chaz Roberts. So I thought, Chaz Roberts, he's in London. I can pop down and have a chat. And that was it. I did the usual obsessive thing of spending weeks comparing tube sets and group sets and all that. And yeah, and I stumped up and got myself a White Spider, which I still have. And it is still immaculate.
Oh, well, that's great. That's really nice to hear. Yeah. And what about the camping gear back then?
That would have been a highly inappropriate sleeping bag. Summer only, I think they advertised them. They were about £10. You pick up in Kmart. Yeah. And you think, this would be brilliant. It's like rated at -2. I thought, -2, I'd be laughing. So you're in it, English summer, you know, it gets cool. It's down to about 4 degrees. It's like, you know, it's suddenly you start putting those layers of clothing on again. It's like, no. So I think as one of the things you learn as you do more camping in general and bicycle touring is there are certain things you shouldn't skimp on. Sleeping bags, panniers, and pannier wraps. Because they will all let you down eventually if you try and skimp on them. But so it would, yeah. My gear has had a progression as I've been able to afford better stuff, and you know, appreciated the better stuff as well. So yeah, it was probably a cheap sleeping bag and a cheap tent that kind of probably lasted one tour, and you know, that was it.
And it's that would have been the era, I guess, where the epitome of quality touring kit would have been tubeless racks, so stainless steel racks and waterproof Ortlieb panniers, which were, you know, always desirable.
Here we go, exactly. I was going to say from hosting, doing warm chats hosting, all probably 80 to 90% of cycle tours have got audio. So they are a very, very popular. It's top quality kit. I was always Caradice and still am. I kind of love, well, it's kind of tapping into the CTC thing. I love Caradice. I love Brooks. You know, so, and Reynolds 531. So all the traditional English, you know, clubmen's tourists, kind of equipment, really.
Yeah. Right. And none of which are owned, you know, by British people or companies anymore. I think Caradice was just bought out. In fact, it made me giggle a while back because I've got these lovely Alpkit camo bikepacking bags now, which I love, although they're MTP rather than DPM, which I prefer the older kind of darker camouflage colours. But Caradice did some camo bikepacking bags, and I think they were DPM, and I was like, oh, they look cool. But then they had these big day glow, yellow, you know, stripes on them, and I was kind of like, well, what are you about? You know, do you want to be seen or not? Is one of those things. But yeah, real classic stuff. So After going to the Isle of Wight, then, what was your first big international tour?
That would have been, that was with a then girlfriend. That was, she, I wanted to get her into touring. So I thought, what's a nice, easy tour with very few hills in countries where they respect cyclists? So I thought, do you know what? Brussels to Amsterdam. And it was brilliant. It was, after cycling in England, it's kind of a culture shock in a nice way. When you come to that first roundabout in Belgium and cars give way to you, it's like, oh my God, this is how it should be. And the same in Holland. You're like, I mean, New Zealand's a bit like the UK where cyclists are definitely second class citizens. And, you know, it's, anyway, but it's, yeah, no, it just, and it was good. We stayed in youth hostels and things all the way through. But again, it was wonderful cycle touring. Easy. I mean, I think it was 800 Ks. And I think we ran over about two hills in Brussels. The rest of it was the cycle paths that just go off through the dunes and by the sea. And you can cycle in the Holland, you can cycle for hours and not see a car. It's brilliant. It's paradise.
I remember speaking to a Dutch cycle campaigner when I was at one of these London cycle meetings. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, this story of getting the ferry over from Hulk of Holland to Harwich. And he just came off the ferry and there was a Dutch family with three children. Like, yeah. All, you know, I think he said they were all under 10 on bikes, just looking completely freaked out because they were on a dual carriageway. And he said to them, what are you doing? And they said, we're cycling to Stonehenge. And he kind of just looked at them and said, well, with three kids, you know, because of course in Holland, you can cycle from anywhere to anywhere with the six-year-olds. Yeah. And they just expected it would be the same. And I was going to ask you, actually, because Carlton Reid, who was on the podcast recently talking about COP26, that's just come out as we speak, although this podcast is going to come out a bit later. Carlton was very disparaging of cycling on the road in New Zealand. He said cyclists have been almost pushed off the road in New Zealand. I certainly found it as a bit of a shock on the road bike, certainly around Auckland. Mm-hmm. Although having said that, I did some lovely road riding in New Zealand, out in the sticks, you know, where there aren't just many people.
Yeah.
So I've experienced great road riding in New Zealand. But would you say, you know, these people are like, oh, I'm going to ride top of the North Island at Wellington. Is it dangerous? Is it, you know, difficult, or are the routes you can find?
Well, they've really upped their game over here now. And there is, I think it's 14 or 15 multi-day cycle trails. And they're eventually, they're going to try and turn into like the Eurovelo system, where you can basically go from Lisbon to Istanbul on, you know, on either dedicated cycle paths or protected or, you know, quiet back, you know, backstreets. And these kind of litter the country. And the plan eventually is to tie them all up. So you can cycle from the very south, like Bluff, all the way through up to Kaitaia, which is about 3,000 kilometers, 3,500 kilometers. Where I live in the Nelson area, there's a, it's called the Great Taste Trail. It's a 180 kilometer loop that goes through vineyards and orchards, and a lot of it's off road, like hard packed gravel, and it's wonderful. It's a nice, easy 3-day tour. There's some beautiful ones down in further down in the South Island. There's one that goes out to ocean. It's 300 kilometers, and you start at about 1,200 meters, and it's basically downhill all the way to the sea, apart from like one hill. And very popular with inexperienced cyclists and e-bikes. There's enough places along the way to keep you charged up each day to do these things. So it's brilliant. People got such a small population. There's dual carriageways are almost non-existent where I am. So you've got busy, what would be A roads in the UK? But they're the national highways. So you've got camper vans and mobile homes and logging trucks and all that. So you kind of got to have your wits about you a wee bit. But I always cycle with a mirror on my glasses. It's gloves on, helmet on, mirror on. And that, to me, that gives me so much more confidence because I can see things coming up behind me, and I know it's like being on the motor. You always want to know what's behind you. Well, I do anyway. So, but around here, once people are not a big city, we're kind of a provincial backwater. Really. Once you get off the highway, there's these valleys. These roads go up these valleys for 20 or 30 k's, and you can cycle up these things and not see another car. And that's where I head on my road bike. So you can do like a 2-hour ride, not see another car, stay off the highway.
And that local knowledge is so important, isn't it? Because I lived in London for a long time, and if you didn't know London, you'd think it was hell for cyclists. And obviously things have improved in the last 15 years or so, thanks largely to Jenny Jones, for getting all of that started, even though other people wrongly took the credit.
Yeah.
But still, you'd think it's not necessarily a great place for cycling, but I found it was incredibly safe if you knew the routes to take. And it was reasonably straightforward to get out to really pleasant, places to cycle and relatively safe places to cycle in the country. So it's all about that local knowledge, isn't it? And our friend Janu Hoogland, who runs International Mountain Bike Magazine, he also runs Ride with the Locals. And it's the whole point is you go traveling somewhere and you ride with someone local to see the trails and such. My sort of goal for New Zealand touring, so I've done a few of those lovely routes in New Zealand, is the old Ghost Road. And it's something I did have planned. When we came to see you in Nelson, we were heading down the South Island, and the plan was to do the old Ghost Road. But my son was, I think he was 8 at the time, or 9, so it would have been quite challenging for him. And it was, when we planned to do it was snowing and cloudy, and I was like, that's definitely going to take him over his limit, because it's this high alpine route with a lot of climbing. You stay in these little bothies, these mountain huts that they have all over New Zealand. And then there's some pretty serious single track, isn't there, with big drop-offs. Have you done the old Ghost Road or considered it, Andy?
I haven't. My partner's sister did it on an e-bike, e-mountain bike, and fell off and went down a ravine. So that... it's kind of on my very, very loose bucket list. One of the reasons why is where it actually comes out, the far end of it, is on the west coast, in a little town called, it's a hamlet called Seddonville. And my girlfriend's brother has just built a little house there. So it's pretty wild country. It's different. There's almost a different vibe down there, a different way of life, because it's old coal mining communities and old railway communities. And there's a heathy track, which is like the gold standard mountain bike track, like multi-day mountain bike tour. It's only open during the winter.
So. Obviously, the old Ghost Road, it's an amazing mountain bike tour. But coming back to road touring, have you ridden in anywhere particularly adventurous or exotic that maybe you thought might be a bit dangerous? And what was your experiences?
Well, I used to work at a bike shop in Nelson, and I decided to have a break from working. And I sold the farm I had. So I had a bit of money, and I planned. The route was planned. I was going to call it the Ring of Fire. And basically, this was the dream, to cycle up the west side of the Pacific Ocean. So that was Australia, Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, Vietnam, Korea, Japan, and then over to North America, and then all the way down to Alaska. I got as far as Japan, so it was kind of half of it. Lots of adventures, lots of great experiences. Probably the toughest section was I started the tour cycling across outback Queensland and Northern Territory, so Cairns to Darwin. That was a proper adventure. The towns and cities and shops can be 300, 400, 500 kilometers apart. So that taught me a lot about forward planning and being prepared for any emergency. You know, anything mechanical on the bike that could stop the tour, medical emergency, things like that. And that was good. That was an experience. And then it kind of, from there, I went to East Timor and then Indonesia, which was a different adventure. You know, you've got narrow road, lots of trucks, but wonderful scenery, tropical climate, cheap food, cheap accommodation. And then Singapore, and then Malaysia, which was highly recommended. That's a great country to tour is Malaysia. Very friendly, roads are safe, very cheap, beautiful climate, lots to see and do. And then my favorite country was Korea, which was, was a big surprise.
Why was that, Andy?
I think after Holland and Belgium, they probably got the finest cycle path network in the world. It's a secret. Very few people know about it. This thing is absolutely stunning. I rode from Seoul, Incheon, 800 kilometers from one side of the country down to Busan on the southeast. And I probably, that was 800 kilometers. I probably rode on maybe 5 kilometers of road. The rest of it was cycle path and, like almost mini highway standard cycle path. And they all, the system over there is called the Four Rivers bike path, bike system. And it's one of the cycling wonders of the world. And if somebody has never been overseas cycle touring, I say go to Korea. There's like nothing else like it. It's wonderful. It's perfect for families and novices. I free camped. I think I had one warm showers host in Incheon. And the rest of it was, I was sleeping in public parks, backs of sports fields and public parks. I didn't have 1 second's hassle. There was not 1 minute I felt unsafe or, you know, I feared. It's like Japan. It's got that kind of, you feel the people respect your space and they leave you alone and nobody bothers you. And it's wonderful. Yeah, that was a great experience. That was, yeah, Korea.
Cool. And, in terms of the equipment that you're riding on, then what had you evolved to with your bike and your kit?
That was the bike, one of my bikes I still use now, which is a Dawes. It's this was a happy accident. It's a Dawes, a 1984 Dawes Cougar mountain bike. And you couldn't, if you custom made a touring bike out of steel, you couldn't make it better than this Dawes Cougar. And I paid $50 for this. And a guy came into the bike shop and just said, anybody buy bicycles? And I look at it and it's like, ooh, Dawes, 531, all mountain bike tubing. I said, yeah. I said, how much? $50, done. And that was it. It's absolutely brilliant. It's better for touring than my Roberts. The Roberts had a slightly shorter chain stay. So I would find occasionally my heel would clip the panniers as you pedal. This Dawes, the geometry on it is just so relaxed. The chain stay is probably 2 centimeters longer than the Roberts, which was enough to give me so much clearance. Lugs for panniers, a pannier rack on the back, horizontal dropout for a roll off, which is what I fitted in there. It was brilliant. It's like beautiful Reynolds 531 steel. So I had money and knowledge to build this. This would be my dream touring bike. I got S&S couplings fitted to it. I sent it to a frame builder. S&S couplings, because I was going to be doing a lot of flights, breaking it down, packing up on buses, things like that. Expensive, but a good investment. And the roll off rear hub, which I built. I built a Sun Rhino rims, and Middleburn, I can't think of the model, but it's a Middleburn crank where you can You can put different chain rings on there. It's super cool. I can't think of the name. Beautiful bit of kit with a specific, and when you, they have a specific roll-off chain ring, and it's designed, when you put it on your bottom bracket, that to give you the perfect chain line. Or obviously with a, when you're riding a hub gear, it's, you kind of got to get that chain line right. Otherwise you're wearing out your chain, you'll drop your chain. And it's, yeah, beautiful kit. Oh, that's it. Just getting a phone call. Yeah. Yeah, we're back. Yeah. So, yeah, perfect. So I spent $50 on the frame and $4,000 turning it into my dream touring bike. I've still got it. I've got a USE shock post, suspension seat post, butterfly bars, pull canty componentry. Absolutely beautiful stuff. Beautifully made stuff. Pull component brakes. A SON 28. The latest one, the latest, like a tennis ball, it's like a round one, with their LED lights and tubeless racks front and rear, and a Brooks, which has done probably 20 or 30,000 k's. This thing is molded to every single hair on my body now. This thing is so broken in, and that was it. And that was it was strong enough, but like. Transcontinental touring, which is what I used it for. It was tough. It had character. It handled beautifully. It had like the really sort of shallow head angle, which gives you that really relaxed all day feeling ride. You know, it's not harsh. The forks soak up the bumps. Yeah, love it. Still got it. It's a dream bike.
Well, it certainly sounds great. So you mentioned warm showers there. So for anyone who's not heard of warm showers, what is it and what's your involvement with it?
Warm showers is, I always describe it as couch surfing for cycling. And it's a perfect example of paying things forward. Nobody does it for money. The cycle tours don't get charged and the people hosting don't charge. So basically, if you're riding a bicycle, you're doing a cycle tour, and you're like a multi-day, a multi-city, a multi-country cycle tour. People offer you, it can be anything from pitching your tent in someone's back garden to a bed, you know, a cooked meal, whatever. It's usually written down on the host's profile. So you kind of get a vibe of what they can do. You can offer this, they can't offer that, you know, they might have dogs, they don't welcome dogs, they might have dogs, or, I mean, I usually put on mine, I can offer a bed, a cooked meal, a vegetarian, laundry service, and a free service of their bicycle, which is what I always love doing. I love meeting people, with a kindred spirit, like with that shared love. So as soon as they turn up at your house, they're hot, they're tired, they're sweaty. They might have been riding 100 k's, 140 k's. I said, look, take your gear off, put it in the washing machine, have a hot shower, I'll cook dinner, come out, and then we can talk. And that was it. And it was wonderful. You got that instant bond. So it's straight away, the conversation flowed, you know, what touring have you been doing? Where are you going? What are you planning? And then it was, the next morning, let's have a look at that bike. And without fail, every bike always needed a little tweak somewhere around. It could have been something as major as changing the oil in a roll-off hub because they'd forgotten to do it or they didn't realize it was a thing as well. 30,000 k's later, how often do you change your oil? What do you mean change your oil? So I would always do that. And that was good. That's a satisfying thing to do. Just going around with a spoke key, just tightening up those spokes, checking the tread, checking, you know, the chain wear. That got lots of use. You know, your chain's good, your cassette's good, or even the warm brake, brake shoes, brake. There was always something. I could always find something to do on the bike to give that little tweak to make, you know, to make them feel good. And, you know, usually the brakes, because coming into Nelson, you've got to go over a lot of hills, so the brakes take a bit of a hammering. So, you know, tweak the brakes, replace the brakes or whatever. There was a bike shop just around the corner for me, so I said, look, this is what you need to kind of keep your bike going in a nice, smooth manner without any nasty spikes. You might need a new cassette, you might need a new chain, new cable. It'll cost you $50, you'll get another 2,000 or 3,000 Ks out of your ride. So, yeah, it was good. The whole experience. And then the flip side is the joy of hosting, which I've done many times, to being hosted, which is a whole different experience. But I think having hosted, I know when I turn up at a stranger's house, I know how they'll feel seeing me on the doorstep, hot and sweaty and stuff. So yeah, that is good. It's a wonderful experience. And I've got people that I hosted many years ago, and I'm still friends with on Facebook. So it's good. I highly recommend it. It's a great experience.
If you want to break into the bike trade, train your staff, or even learn some new skills just for fun, Cycle Systems Academy has a course for you. Our graduates come to us from all over the globe and train with us to gain the highest recognised cycle mechanic qualifications available. The bike industry supports and believes in Cycle Systems Academy, which means they'll believe in you too.
It really is one of the great joys, isn't it, of the internet age. I read a book, must have been in the early 90s, and it was about this English bloke who, when he turned 50, he wanted to go on a pilgrimage. He'd read in India that at 50 you were allowed a year off work and you could just go off on a pilgrimage, and people would walk and beg as they walked, and they would get hosted and looked after because of the, you know, Hindu culture. And he thought, wouldn't it be great if we could do that in England? And he was from Newcastle, so he decided to. He went somewhere down south, can't quite remember where, and he walked back to Newcastle, you know, out, completely outside normal English culture.
Yeah.
But what was amazing is every night, bar one, where he slept in a barn, someone put him up and fed him. You just literally go in a pub and say, I'm doing this, can I stay with you? And it was amazing. He stayed with the local toffs who went fox hunting. He stayed with people with, you know, quite serious issues in inner city estates. It's a really great book. And at the end of the book, he says, wouldn't it be great if there was a walking club where we could host people and then we could be hosted when we went out adventuring? And of course, now we have it. You know, there's lots of these kind of apps, but Warm Shower has been specifically about cycle touring. It's so great. I mean, imagine compared to rocking up at a Premier Inn or a crusty hostel full of teenagers getting drunk. You rock up at Andy's place, and by the way, I can attest that Andy's got a very well-stocked fridge full of beer. Fascinating conversation, which we talked well into the night. I do remember that. And getting your bike serviced. I mean, how cool is that? So anyone who's touring curious, definitely get to warmshowers.com and get the app.
Yes.
So one of the great things about being hosted by Andy, apart from the food, the beer, the conversation, the culture, and getting your bike serviced, is that Andy's got a really cool collection of bikes. I wouldn't say it's quite like a museum, but it's not far off. So tell us about some of your cool bikes.
Well, I tell you what, it's mushroomed, burgeoned since you last saw it, and I think
blimey,
yeah, it's gone from a hobby to actually a problem and an addiction and I don't know when it goes from obsession to addiction or whatever, but I'm kind of hovering around there. I'm not as bad as some things I've got, but it's I'm just about keeping the lid on it. I had to have a builder build an extension literally on the side of the house to put some more bikes in. So it's problematic. It is problematic. But the way I said, these things, I don't spend a fortune on them. I don't spend a fortune maintaining them. And these things, I could never afford to own a classic car. I wouldn't know that I'd want to, or even a high-end classic motor. I can afford to own a classic bicycle. And it's almost every bike I've got five speed, you know, from five speed up to 11 speed. They almost all work in exactly the same way. That's one of the geniuses of the bicycle. And it's, and the parts are interchangeable and this, that really is a whole subculture. Excuse me, the bike collecting, wherever you are. It's got a good following in this country. There's enough people in New Zealand that are enthusiasts and connoisseurs that have all these parts. You know, if you need an 8-speed Dura-Ace chainset, somebody will have one, and they might want to swap that with, you know, your Planpac Veloci. So it's a great little community just within New Zealand. An idea of my collection. I'll list the last three bikes I've just acquired and I'm just restoring. The first one is a Condor, a 1975 Condor Italia, which I've just painted it back the original color. I've got the decals, I've got the Reynolds decals for it, and I've got a beautiful old Suntour Superb group set, the original Superb, which is on my Holdsworth, which is going to go on the Condor. So we'll keep it roughly timed, you know, within a couple of years, like era specific, era correct, passing of components. The second frame, which I've just bought, is an SBDU Rally, that's 1986 special development unit, special bike development unit, where the one with the four. The one all the people want, the SB and the four digits on the serial number. That's whenever anybody sells an old rally, what's the serial number? Everybody wants to know what the serial number is. It's usually workshop for W, but if it's got the SB, it's like, oh yes, yeah, that's the one for me. That one's in the Panasonic, the old racing team color, white, blue, red, brick. So I've got the decals for that, and that's going to be restored, and that's going to have 600, Shimano 600, the original without the arabesque or late or tricolor 600. Yeah. And the last one, which I actually got yesterday, which is a New Zealand made frame. And it was an old early 90s time trial frame made in Reynolds 731OS, that's a bit of an oddity. That beautifully light, quite fat tubing. And this thing is running 650 wheels. It's superb pro hubs. Campag win, but 650. It's it's odd. It's a straight, having those slightly smaller wheels, then they're just noticeably smaller. But this thing's beautiful old time proper. Handmade by a guy who just passed away, Frank Clavitz, who kind of renowned in the New Zealand frame building circuit history, pedigree of the country. And it's got Kuka cranks. I'd never heard of them. And then just before I was talking to you, I went down a Kuka crank set, chain set rabbit hole. So I kind of, that's the beauty of cycling. I mean, every now and then a component will pop up that you're not familiar with. And it's like, I've never heard of it. So you kind of, me, I'm a bit like the campaign kid. I want to know, oh, where does that bring? You know, somebody had a Shimano Santi group set. Have you seen one of those?
Yeah, the white person, isn't it? Yeah.
And it was, he said, oh, I looked at it, and that fitted between Dual Ace and 600 Altegra. There was like a little, tiny little gap, obviously. And they put this sandy group set. So, but this is the, what I love about it, that the history and the history of it, just even the parts and, you know, what parts went on where and, you know, what bikes came with what parts and, yeah, no, and just handling these beautiful old, not quite works of art. I suppose our engineering works like that. The precision in them, just the feel. I mean, an old 8-speed Dura-Ace derailleur or a Campy 10-speed record shifter. All these things. It's like it's just using them as a joy, and it's an affordable joy. I mean, if somebody's a connoisseur of whiskey, they're going to be spending thousands. But you can have a beautiful old English frame flight around, an old Columbus, an old, you know, pick up an old Italian bike and kit it out in original kit for $300, $400, $500, a couple hundred pounds. So I see it as a cheap hobby that gives so much. It's a pleasure to restore them, to buy them. Just hunting parts down is a joy. So it's the joy of collecting and finding that one piece. I've been looking for an Ultegra 6603 front mech, which is the 6600 series, but with an Ultegra triple chain set, which I've got, and it's not too many of them. But I'll find it one day, and that's finding that front mech will give me just a little tingle of joy.
I know we certainly did have one of those at the Cycle Systems Academy, but I'm pretty sure it was trashed quite a while ago. I know, but we did have a 6603 group set on one of the bikes way back in 2010 or so. But they don't. Nothing lasts that long when students are hacking away at it and learning their trade, you know. And I think that's the great thing about Pedro's tools is those tools are in daily use by people who are learning. So if they stand up and they keep on working, and you know, some of them are sort of 13, 14 years later, then you know they're going to be good. And anything that is...
John, you can always tell the good stuff, the really good stuff, whether it's bike tools or power tools, whether it's what the professionals use. People, even like painters and decorators, you ask them what brush, they'll have a specific brush that they use that's made for professional quality. So just using professional tools, the fact that they're the ones that are chosen by the people that need these things day in, day out, 8 hours a day, you know, 52 weeks of the year. So to me, there is no better recommendation than a tool. What do the pros use? Oh, they use Pedro, they use Park, whatever. That's for me. It costs a bit more, but they last three or four times as long or more.
Yeah, and that of course is the business model for cycling, isn't it? It's like, oh, what bike is, you know, so and so winning the Tour de France on? You know, that's desirable. And of course, as we've talked about in the podcast previously, the bike that Matthew Van Der Poel rides, well, it isn't suitable for people because the handlebars break. You know, to me, isn't it? That a pro's bike isn't necessarily what, you know, you'd want. But if you were, you know, speaking to someone who's a brand new cycle tourer and you're saying, look, this is what the round the world cycle tourers ride. You know, like you said, if you get sort of good quality kit that will last, what would be your recommendation for a dream touring bike from the ground up for someone?
I think that technology is kind of, like you say, now technology is caught up with cycle touring, or cycle touring is caught up with technology. And, you know, you couldn't look past a really nicely made gravel bike. And personally, I'd have the E-Cup, the Campag system on there. Because that kind of gives you the option of road touring. And if you fancy some off-roady, gravelly, like some of the trails we have in this country, a swap of the tires, maybe a few tweaks, and you can take that bike from a road tourer to an off-road tourer, you know, which is obviously the niche that gravel bikes are. And the good ones tend to come with a lot of the front lugs for front panniers and rear panniers. Other than that, Shirley long haul trucker. It's the industry standard. I've lost count how many Shirley long haul truckers I've served from Warm Showers guests. I think at least 30 or 40% ride Shirley. And they're great bikes. They got a lot of pedigree. They're not too expensive. They're affordable. They're good but affordable. Beautifully made. They're steel and they've got every lug you could ever imagine. So but other than that, if you wanted something a bit quicker, gravel bike with a bike packing setup. Over here we have the big, every January, February, there's a thing called the Tour de Aotearoa. And it's an off-road ride for 3,000 kilometers from Kaitaia down to Bluff. And a good chunk of the riders, I mean, it's all bike packing. You've got to be self-supported. A good chunk of them do use gravel bike. A lot of hard-tailed, a lot of gravel bikes. And they all kind of, you know, they all get through. So, yeah.
And it's great now, isn't it, with the gravel bikes? Because I've actually never owned a dedicated touring bike. You know, like when I was a kid, right. My dad had a Falcon Olympic Tourer, and I always thought it was the squarest thing. You know, I was a teenager, I was into racing, right? But I've never had a touring bike. So what I've always used in the past touring was either just a mountain bike, that's what I had. So, you know, cheap steel mountain bike, or a cyclocross bike. And what I found is with the cyclocross bikes is because they're much shorter wheelbase than a gravel bike. It's one of the differences. And as soon as you put mudguards on a cyclocross bike, you get that toe overlap. So you can smash your mudguard into your foot with entertaining consequences if you're not careful. Whereas the gravel bike, because it's got that longer wheelbase, it's designed for longer, more stable riding. It is much, much more like a traditional touring geometry, is it not?
I've got to be honest, I've never ridden a gravel bike. Not to say I never will, but I've got friends with it. I think one of the great advantages, as well as if you can have like a 1x12 or 1x13 group set on it, which is what I, so instantly you've removed a front mech and a front shifter. So you've simplified it again. You've simplified the chain line, but they tend to have a lot of clearance. So you can be running 700, you know, 35, 40 with a bit of tread on to do, to give you more versatility for your bike touring. Like, you know, if you wanted to, there was a shortcut across a mountain bike track from one road to another. You can do it on those kind of bikes.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And they're pretty good on the road. I mean, my gravel bike, which is completely humble, you know, it's a Rally Mustang, meant after an old mountain bike. It's SRAM Apex. It's all real kind of cheapy bog standard. It's like a brick, you know. Yeah. But it's just brilliant. You know, I've been riding it. I've got this new 2-hour loop around Burn that I've got at the moment that I tend to do in the mornings before work. And it's just great. You know, it just does it all. And it, as you say, it's got clearance for so much. And when I came to New Zealand, it was kind of before the gravel bikes got really big, and we were buying secondhand anyway. We bought bikes and camping stuff and then traveled and then sold it at the end. And I had an old steel Kona cyclocross bike, which I thought this is going to be good for a bit of everything. And what I found is these New Zealand touring tracks that we did the Timber Trail with, the first one, and they're really tough. You know, they're not just tough physically, but they're tough on the bike. And we were getting broken panniers because it was all fairly budget secondhand stuff. Mm-hmm. So we definitely, although the pannier bags we were using were Tula, like really nice Tula ones. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got the hooks that hook onto the racks. It's where you press that part and it rotates round so they don't get caught on things when you carry the bags. Have you seen those? So really nice bags. Yeah. But they were breaking because it was off-road riding. And we were riding down the Timber Trail, this lovely trail in the beautiful mid-North Island, and quite tough riding. And we saw this couple who were on plus-size mountain bikes, which were quite new at the time, about 3-inch tyres, with all the bike packing bags. And we were there. Julia was on a hybrid with 35C road tyres, like she was commuting in London. My son was on a 26-inch, really heavy Kona mountain bike, like the sort of thing that would have been entry-level. And I was on this Jake the Snake. And we saw these guys come past with all of their bags and their big tires, and we were like, "Yes!" And we were like, "Yeah, if you're going to do this sort of riding, that's pretty amazing." And now I've got this gravel bike with the bike packing bags. Like I say, I've got this Alp kit. I was a complete tar. Alp kit did this limited edition camo, and I'm like, "I'm going to get everything," you know. So I've got this Let's Off Road kind of camo waterproof bike packing kit, and it's just awesome. And with the modern camping stuff, which compacts down so small, I can carry it all through, you know, really easily, and that's my perfect setup. So I completely agree with you on that. I think if I was buying, you know, if money was no object, I'd be looking at a roll-off belt drive bike for sure. I'd be looking at a custom steel frame, and certainly I really love both the bike packing bags, because they just strap on, there's nothing to break or snap there, or some of the modern racks, you know, and bags and such, which look quite sturdy. But I'm pretty sold, really, on just strapping bags to your bikes and buying, because I've got super lightweight camping kit anyway for walking, so it all fits in together. Yeah. So obviously, we can talk bikes and cycle touring all night, but the other thing we can talk about all night is music, because you're a fellow music lover. So I wanted to get into some of the latest bands you've come across and who you're listening to at the moment.
I'm more into the Spotify, but it's, do you use Spotify at all?
I mean, it's great for discovering people, isn't it?
Discover Weekly. I've got some new traditions. You get like the daily mixes, but every week you get new release playlist and Discover Weekly. I work my way through both of those. They're kind of, the Discover Weekly tends to tie into your algorithm. The stuff you've been listening to for the last couple of weeks, I'll kind of work some of it in. So you could have something like Parliament, Maggot Brain from Parliament, or the Indestructible Beat of Soweto, one after the other, then a bit of Frank Sinatra, and, you know, whatever. And it's such an eclectic, you know, it's your own eclectic mix of music that you kind of like, or possibly will like, or, you know, the other ones you can take or leave. And it's wonderful. I've heard so much new music, new old music and new music as well. And, you know, it's just how it feeds into your tastes as well. I must admit, I do listen to a lot of early 70s adult rock, a lot of Doobie Brothers and Steely Dan. I've got to admit, I'm kind of showing my age a bit, I'm coming up to 60, and it's nice just to put something like that on, and but go into the album, and, you know, with the Spotify, obviously, you know, it's you can just listen to any of the albums and the new mixes and the, you know, whatever, and that's good. It's but as for new bands, I can't. There's nothing I can recommend. There's nothing I can say. Well, this is a great band to listen to. Sorry about that.
That's all right. I mean, I can jump in there because I get on Spotify. I came across Days and Days. Don't know if you've come across them. So the first Days as in Monday, Tuesday, and then the second Days as in I'm completely wasted and in a daze. And they're from Texas, and they describe themselves as thrashgrass. And it is, it's all acoustic, although their latest single isn't actually, but it's pretty much all acoustic. But the guitar is like full on thrash, you know, at times. It's got hints of mariachi, like trumpet playing, brass in there as well. And these guys take a lot of drugs, right? They're pretty wild alcoholics, all the rest of it. So the stories, the songwriting and the stories is breathtaking.
Wow.
You know, definitely channeling Shane McGowan.
Yeah.
But really special music, and I find it's definitely music for our times. It's quite nihilistic. Wow. That's kind of how everyone's feeling at the moment, you know, going a bit crazy. So
ZZ Top with banjos.
I'd say not, though, because as I say, it's more like if Slayer played acoustic guitars and drank more and took more drugs. So you'd have Days and Days there. You know, imagine your local street alcoholic picking up a guitar and sounding amazing. It is literally that. You know, it's one of the few bands. If you go on their website, the band bio has got various rest in peace formed band members.
Wow. They made their dues then.
Oh, well, definitely.
I'll go down the Days and Days rabbit hole.
I find if you put them on, if you just like press play, and I'll walk in the woods for an hour or two and I'm just still listening to them, because there's something about them that's just so great. So,
well, one of the great features of Spotify is you might have an album that you of a favorite band, and you kind of listen to that album forever. And you think, do you know what? Let's go for a deep dive, and then you start listening to, you know, their first album, and then the follow-up album, and then the one that you like the most, and what came after. And it's great. And it's technology working. technology making your life easier, I guess.
Yeah, it's not really working for the artists, I will say that. So
yeah,
I like to discover stuff on Spotify and then support the artists best I can, but Sorry?
Have you got anything recorded? Have you got anything on Spotify?
Only this podcast. I mean, my music making is strictly amateur. Right. Julia has. So Julia Lally is on Spotify, my wife, and I'm her biggest fan. And she's done one album. She was recording it when I met her back in 1998. And that's a brilliant album called Spirit. So if you're listening and, you know, you want a bit of genius singer-songwriting, that's a really, really classy album.
Over the years, you think of how many singer-songwriters get rediscovered. I mean, like Nick Drake. I mean, he couldn't sell an album in his lifetime. And now, you know, every single album is gold. You know, Tim Buckley, Tim Harden. I mean, there's the same, Eve Cassidy. And they you know, in their lifetime, Julie's thankfully still with us, but they couldn't get arrested. And then people discover them, you know, 10, 20, 30 years later. Vashti Bunyan?
I came across her recently, yeah.
Yeah, there's so many of them out there. And so you never know, Julia might get discovered. You know, you never know. Yeah,
indeed, or certainly deserves to. I mean, as you know, I've been in Switzerland about a year now.
Mm-hmm.
And the great thing about playing traditional Irish music is people play it everywhere. It's a bit like cycling. You've got this worldwide community. So I've met the Irish music players here in Bern. But my neighbours, I found out, funnily enough, I met them. They knocked on the flat and said, oh, sorry, our little boy, who's about 3 or 4, has been stealing your post and tearing it up. That's how we met. Yeah.
Oh, no.
It's not, I don't care, you know. It's, I said, okay, you know, fine. But anyway, we were chatting away, and it turns out this family are a musical family, and they play Balkan music. So I've been going around to their place, and they've been learning some Irish tunes, and I'm attempting to learn these Bulgarian horrors and such. And it's just great to meet, you know, creative musical people, you know, filmmakers, theatre, all the rest of it. So...
Some of that, the Bulgarian, I remember in the 80s, Bulgarian chanting. Remember that? There was a couple of albums come out and they kind of, again, went gold, like Gregorian chanting did for it. And it is really, really haunting music. It is the close harmonies and the singing. It's stunning. I highly recommend Bulgarian chanting. It's quite trippy. It's quite trippy music. Really relaxing.
It is. It's funny, isn't it? There's certain countries, like if you're into African music, Mali is one of the powerhouses of Africa. Like, why is that? It just is. And then in Europe, obviously I'm biased, but I think Ireland's got the greatest traditional music well, of anywhere. But it is incredible, you know? Yes. And then you get into the Balkans, and there's something about Bulgaria where they've got this incredible tradition of crazy dance music, amazing singing traditions. And I know there's amazing stuff everywhere. There really is, but... There is very, very special. And funnily enough, in the 70s, people like Andy Irvine and that from Planxty went hitchhiking around Eastern Europe, and they brought some of that stuff back to Ireland. So Johnny Moynihan brought the Greek bouzouki back and developed that to the Irish bouzouki. And there's a few old 70s Irish albums with Bulgarian tunes on.
I think Donald Lunny brought one of those traditional Eastern European guitars as well.
He got it from Johnny Moynihan was the first guy, and then other people. Andy Irvine picked it up, and then Andy Irvine, I'm pretty sure, introduced it to Donald Lunny, who's now he's like the master of the bouzouki.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
All bouzouki players want to be Donald Lunny. Or Andy Irvine. But anyway, we could do a podcast just about their respective styles.
I've got a few Donald Lunny albums, actually. I'm a big fan of his.
He's really, really good. So obviously, the great thing is now with these, I've got these bone-conducting headphones, which means I can listen to music while I can still hear people screaming at me or cars and trucks and such. So you can combine music and cycling safely these days.
Yeah.
So Andy, really great chat, really enjoyable, yes, really fantastic to catch up. If people are interested and want to connect with you or find you on Warm Showers, where can people find you online, if they can, or do you not want to be found?
My life isn't that interesting, but if you do find yourself cycle touring in New Zealand, you have got a warm shower, a warm bed, a cooked meal, and a bike service. If you're ever in Richmond, so obviously my name, Andy Pettit, on Warm Showers, everybody welcome. Mention this podcast and you'll get a discount. I mean, you'll get an extra beer. There we go.
Well, you can't say fairer than that. So, Andy, so nice to speak to you. Obviously, travel in the world is still a bit fucked up, so I've got no idea when or if we'll get back to New Zealand again, but I have got unfinished business there for sure. Yes. So I hope to get back and see you soon.
Wonderful. See you soon. Bye. Bye.